I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us. Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I thought we'd take a minute today and talk a little bit about things that are going on and how they may be interrelated or how they may not be interrelated, but a couple of years ago, it was announced that we were making a big shift from the Middle East to the Pacific. Some call it the Asian pivot. But during that time, we've had things flare up in Ukraine. We've had problems with ISIL in the Middle East. There have been other problems since the strategy was announced. And my question, and I don't know the answer to this, is, and I think it's the question that a lot of people have, is, was the Asian strategy to pivot to Asia, was it a misstep, or is it a pivot that we need to make? Do the referees need to call foul and give the ball to somebody else, or what's the, because we were traveling, or what do we need to do here?
I don't think it changes anything what's going on with ISIL and Ukraine, because the pivot mainly involved naval forces. The Air Force would make plans to send more aircraft squadrons overseas to the Pacific, but that was mostly getting ready on the Pacific side, to receive them. Where are we going to put them, making arrangements, what have you. We already have plenty of arrangements, as it were, in the Middle East and in NATO to get more air power over there if it's needed. The only forces we might have to send to the West, as it were, would be aircraft if there were going to be more bombing in Syria and Iraq. But remember, we already have the infrastructure and the arrangements, as it were, over there. And given the fact that Saudi Arabia is very angry at ISIL, we'd probably be able to use their air base. They have an extensive network of air bases, which we helped build. And so I don't see any problem with the pivot, because we don't need a lot of naval forces over there. So the main problem is send in air power and special forces, as it were, against ISIL, and do whatever we have to do with Russia. Again, the main problem with Russia, the main weapon against Russia, is economic. Their economy is their biggest weakness, and that's where we're hitting. And that's where we're hurting. And it's the same thing with ISIL, with the air power. We've already started in Iraq, and that's hurt them very badly, and they're very angry about it. I mean, they've said that when they killed these two Americans so publicly, that they want us to stop the bombing. Well, that's one thing we shouldn't do, and we told them that. It's a tragedy. You're murdering people, Americans, and apparently Britain is up next, and the British have already said, look, you bastards, we're going to get you for this if you do it. Of course, ISIL, as we know, they've been around for a long time. They started out as a Iraqi terrorist organization. And the only thing they respond to is, death from above.
Austin, what is your feeling about the Asian pivot?
Well, look, the long-term challenge, and I'm not putting this strictly in military terms, political, economic, diplomatic, which would be a component of the political as well, is how to deal with, best deal with China. That's not a new insight, Dan. I'm going to quote Andy Marshall, the longtime head director of the Office of Net Assessments and the Secretary of Defense's office. In the early 1990s, one of the questions that he asked of the futurists, defense futurists, and in the U.S. and in the West was how do we address the changes and rise of China? And it's a long term issue. Just to give you an example of this, and then I'll really try to give you a thorough answer to your question. I participated in a couple of open source, non-classified exercises in, I want to say, 94, 95, that it addressed this issue, both politically and in terms of security. And this is not all, hey, there's an imminent war between the U.S. and China. That was not the way it was taken, because we still realize there are lots of reasons and lots of ways that the U.S. and China not only cooperate, but accommodate one another's interests. So the pivot, per se, by the Obama administration was, in some ways, I realize that the assets had not moved, but the awareness of China as and the Western Pacific as a potential theater of conflict is not new at all. The other thing is that if Jim started to point this out, the quote unquote infrastructure for supporting American allies if China becomes an aggressive hegemonist, and Dan, have we had indications that it could? Why, of course we could have South China Sea. The Vietnamese certainly see them as expansionary, and the concern by the Japanese and the South Koreans is that the Chinese government is nationalist, just playing on nationalist themes, and is expansionary. But the infrastructure is already there. You have Okinawa, Guam, relationship with Singapore, U.S. lost Subic Bay at Manila, but now the Filipinos, the Chinese rambunctiousness has changed Filipino perceptions and said that the U.S. isn't an old imperialist anymore. And you have John McCain as one of the chief advocates for, I don't know, maybe Jim can remember this or not, but Senator McCain's all but said that he sees U.S. and Vietnamese cooperation. I don't know if he used the term alliance or not, but the Vietnamese wouldn't mind that, in based on what I read with what they have to say. You also have Taiwan, and you have, of course, China and South Korea. And there is right there not only the geographic positions, so peninsulas, islands, and in the case of Vietnam, on land, geographic positions, but naval and military assets for pivoting and containing China. And then China itself, when it looks at itself, it could be surrounded because they've got India to deal with as a potential adversary. Remember, there's still unresolved border issues from 1962 between India and China. So really what I'm painting up a picture of is that the Obama administration, I mean, you can read it two ways. One is, well, this is something that's concerned U.S. security analysts for a long time. It's time to reorient as we restructure and downsize our forces. You could also say, and I believe that there was some element to this as well, a political theater on the Obama administration's part, saying, you know, we're not like the Bush administration. And I'm not taking it to task on that. Other folks already have. But that's there's a legitimate point to looking at China as the major challenge. And, you know, a thing on strategy page, listen to strategy talk, Austin saying, there's a war with China. No, I'm not. But it's a long-term security challenge. Jim's analysis, I think, of what ISIS represents is darn solid. We also have the pieces there for dealing with ISIS. And as you know from past strategy talks, I think we had a stabilized Iraq and bad policy choices, bad leadership choices, really on the part of the United States and the Iraqi government sacrificed that stability. And, hey, a very aggressive anti-Western, anti-American enemy took advantage of it.
Jim, as we move, I want to sort of shift a little bit. As we move forward in this Asian policy, what I know you've written about how China is preparing for different things, and I think there were some articles this week about it. Does our shift make them uneasy? Does it cause them to react in certain ways? What is their reaction to the shift?
Well, as much as we know from open discussions in the Chinese military, which is how they get these discussions started for the classified area, is they are concerned. They believe that with their current weapons, they can handle maybe one or two carriers. But if we have more than, say, two carrier task forces out there, plus, you know, whatever, you know, secret number of American aircraft squadrons, you know, transferred, the odds against them would be very high. In other words, they probably would not succeed.
All right, hello. I'm sorry, I could not hear what Jim said other than I think he called my name. What?
Yeah, he said we're still getting the noise.
The Chinese believe that if we get enough carriers out there, they won't be able to handle it. And, of course, if they do attack, if they do decide to move on us militarily, they stand to lose a lot if their attack does not work, because their basic strategy, from what they've discussed and from Chinese history, is to make a grab for, say, Taiwan, and then to sue for peace and threaten nuclear war if we don't. Now, of course, they don't have nukes that can reach the United States right now, but that's another issue which they're working on. So, yes, they are concerned about the pivot, and they would very much like it if we did not pivot. But the pivot is underway, and that puts them at a disadvantage for now. But they think long-term. They think, well, not now. In 10, 20 years, we'll get them.
Okay, let's shift back to the other part of the world. Russia has made some pushes on Ukraine this week. What is happening there, and what are the ramifications of it?
Well, they're following their strategy. As Austin pointed out, Russia has a strategy. We don't. They are basically using this attack, admit nothing, and keep going. And then Putin comes out and says, if you try and do anything to us, we'll use nukes. Now, what he doesn't say, if he's going to try to nuke his way out of sanctions. As I said, that's their biggest vulnerability. And that doesn't require any pivot. It requires, some negotiations. And when they implemented, a few taps on the screen. Now, they're already unleashed their hackers on our banks, which is a warning shot, as it were, to basically, get the banks to back off. The banks are really neutral on this, but, banks can be intimidated. Anybody can be intimidated. And intimidation is the Russians' biggest weapon. That's what they're doing in Ukraine. They were losing 2 weeks ago, that they invaded. They sent several thousand troops in there, denied that they're there, even though some of them were captured, that are some dead, some alive. They made up excuses. In other words, they can't be trusted. They basically disgusted everybody. And again, as Austin pointed out, this is the 71st anniversary of their infamous treaty with the Nazis in 1939, in which they agreed to carve, it was a secret treaty at the time, where they literally agreed to carve up Eastern Europe between them. And, of course, it was the Germans who reneged on that by invading in 1941. But, the Russians gained a lesson from that hey, you can gain a lot by lying and cheating and denying and basically, playing dirty. And that's exactly what they're doing. They have a strategy. We know what it is. What are we going to do in return? We haven't decided.
Austin, you wrote a little bit about something called Rubik this week in your column. Explain what that is and how that is involved with the strategy that the Russians are involved with.
Let me make a comment on your general topic, though, first, coming out of what Jim just said. It's strangely enough, today when we're recording this, there are two articles that I noticed that were available on the web talking about Obama administration's three challenges, and they listed Ukraine, Russia, ISIS, and China. One even had a nice picture of Abu Bakr, the senior Chinese leadership, and a picture of Putin. So, I mean, the major media, at least a certain level, is now aware of this. They weren't. They certainly didn't go into any depth about the Chinese challenge issue in terms of American defense concerns. And it, neither of them went into any real depth, too, about ISIS taking advantage of a power vacuum. The reason I mention that, Dan, is because in our own way here on Strategy Page, we're talking about those three. They aren't the only major U.S. and I'll say Western, and including in that Western, I'm including Japan and South Korea and Singapore. I know Jim may chuckle about that, but we've had a discussion about what constitutes the West, and Singapore and Japan and South Korea, as well as Australia, often crop up in it because you nests and of common interests and in the case of Japan, common interest in what China's going to do. Same thing applies actually to Singapore. Now, let's move back to your question about the Rubik, RUBK, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan. Now, I came up as a play on words, and I actually think the first time I came up with it was in the late 1990s as Rubik off of Rubik's Cube. But you can look back at the what was called the post-Cold War edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War, which Jim and I were working on in 1991. And remember, the USSR officially collapses on December 31st, 1991. If I recall correctly, the book actually came out in early 1992. But one of the scenarios we analyzed was not just the USSR falling apart, but if it came back together, what would it consist of? Or would somebody eventually try to put it back together? And of course, we had this a core Russian state that had Russia and Belarus, White Russia. Ukraine certainly added to it. Didn't have a cool name for it, but it was there. And some of the what we call the quote unquote Muslim or Central Asian Soviet republics, but particularly Kazakhstan with all of its resources. So I'm not sure off the top of my head that we named Kazakhstan specifically. But it was contained in there, just looking forward and using what I will call just common sense, history, and classical geographic analysis and demographic analysis of what makes a powerful state. And if you add the nuclear weapons and some of the retained the military capabilities of Russia, what makes a global power? Now, I'm going to say in late 92, early 93, Dan, I'm pulling a active duty for training, I think I was at a conference in Washington, and a fellow I know who was a mid-level Pentagon official career came up to me and said, "Hey, I read that book that you and Jim Dunnigan, that new version of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War," and he said, "We did some gaming in 91 inside the Pentagon, and I don't think it was associated with anything, I'm sure it wasn't, with any folks that I had worked with, that they actually came up with a similar conclusion. There's going to be someone or some group that wants to rebuild a core Russian power state. Good on you and Jim for, doing that." And I said, he said, "Where did you get your ideas?" And I just kind of smiled at him. I said, we're just thinking about, Russian history, Russian mentality, and what goes on. Eventually, somebody's going to drop their guard or whatever. Yeah, right. So that's a 92, early 93 conversation. What's going on? What Putin is attempting to do now is old news, Dan. And that's the point of that recent call. You take Russia, which has, and Jim's written about this extensively. I mean, the last edition of The Quick and Dirty Guide to War really had a tremendous amount of material on it. I think the third edition did in 96, but Russia's demographic decline, all of its internal problems, which is one thing Putin and his government would like the Russian people to forget. Well, they're not dealing with their real problems, so let's externalize it. And part of externalizing, let's have a war that's, we're going to be great again. But if you do take and acquire Ukraine, not only do you get in the eastern Ukraine the industrial aspect, industrial infrastructure, but then, as I've said in a talk I gave on this, I've actually given this speech a couple of times in the last 10 years, Ukraine is like Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, South Dakota. It's a breadbasket. It's an agricultural boon. You add its population, and Belarus, and Putin has a lot of effective, if not outright, and it's not outright control over Kazakhstan, but he's sort of, given the relationship that already exists between the dictatorship in Belarus and the Kremlin, rebuilt part of the Rubik. And right now the operation he's using is defending ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine from Ukrainian fascists. As Jim has pointed out, that's just playing on old World War II elements of Ukrainians who were anti-Russian, who joined the German forces, and therefore they were Nazis or fascists. Some of them were. But that's the operation to achieve this expansion. And he's also very careful about it. He's shown that he's willing to take bits and pieces. He's also got some interim objectives, I think. One is he doesn't want Ukraine to be part of NATO. Well, he doesn't want Poland to be part of NATO. He doesn't want Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia to be part of NATO. That frustrates building a greater Russian state. I know there are plenty of analysts that say, hey, that's not what he's up to. But I think I make a reasonable case that, hey, if Putin's not up to it, who is? And will someone eventually do it? I refer to the 1992 and 93, the elements are there, and unless opposed, someone within the Kremlin is going to try to impose that. And I think Putin's up to it. So he's imposing, and who's opposing him? Ukraine's not doing a very good job, and NATO's disorganized.
Jim, I think one of the problems that those of us that live in the West, and this includes Europe and other Western countries, is when we look at what's happening in the Ukraine, it's been such a long time since we've seen a major power try to grab territory back. How the motives that are motivating Putin and the others, how do they differ from the way we in the West view things?
Well, the Russian situation is somewhat unique. Turkey, for example, lost its empire almost 100 years ago, 1920s actually. And they never tried to get it back. Austro-Hungary, same thing. Germany did in 1939 and 1941. And they were acting for the same reasons that Putin is. In other words, it was domestic politics. Putin basically is restoring many elements of the Soviet Union. In other words, a police state. He's doing it in the guise of a democracy, which is a common form of dictatorship. You see it all throughout the Arab world. I mean, that was Mubarak in Egypt when he was overthrown in 2012. He was an elected president, but the elections were rigged. So Putin is basically, installed, he's not completely there yet, a rigged democracy. And he wants to keep that and his wealthy backers, intact. And the way he's doing this is with nationalism. He's found that there was a survey. There have been several surveys, which are fairly reliable in Russia, showing that a lot of people still now believe that losing the empire is a mistake. I mean, the empire has been around for over 300 years. The Tsar put it together. I mean, they basically were still working on it in the 19th century. And it was lost after, the end of World War I, and the Soviets, the communists, put it back together again in the 1920s. But what Putin has undoubtedly also noticed, that the desire for empire is less among younger Russians. In fact, younger Russians don't care about the empire. So time is not on Putin's side. If he wants to stay out of jail or keep his successors out of jail, he's got to keep the police state going. And the only way he can do that is to show some progress in restoring the empire, which appeals to nationalistic Russian, attitudes and what have you. But again, the important thing is it's a generational thing. Putin basically grew up, became an adult during the Soviet period. He was a KGB officer. but he's the last generation that really cares anything about the empire. So he's going to keep doing this unless he's slapped down. And he's, again, I point out, and this is no secret, Putin knows it, most Western leaders know it, his biggest vulnerability is the Russian economy. And the corruption which accompanied Putin's, you know, rigged democracy is very unpopular in Russia, and it's hurting the economy. People, foreign companies, and even Russian companies do not want to do business. I mean, one thing that came out of the imposition of some economic sanctions was the disclosure of the fact that Western banks, Western, you know, countries, major countries, have analyzed, you know, cash flows in Russia, and they've noticed that $1 trillion has left Russia, you know, in the last, you know, decade or so. In other words, a lot of the money Russians are making, including Putin's allies, is being moved out of the country because they realize this thing might blow up in their faces. And if Putin loses in Ukraine, it's more likely to blow up in his face. In other words, indictments, people go to jail, lose their fortunes and what have you. So it's the same thing that powers Putin's problem is time. It's against him. The corruption is also a problem. He's tried to address it. He's only been able to take it so far. He's basically gotten himself into a mess that he's having a very difficult time getting out of. Now, Putin knows this. Most Western leaders know this. The problem is in Europe, where many of the 28, you know, European countries in the European Union do not want to press Russia hard economically because they're... Russia's a major trading partner for Western Europe. It's not just the gas coming in, and they're already looking elsewhere for their gas supplies. Again, they do not trust Russia. Russia knows this. So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And so no matter what Putin may say about nukes and what have you, it's all about the money. As we said in the United States not too long ago, it's the economy, stupid. And he's got very big economic problems, even without his little game in Ukraine and the accompanying sanctions. So he is not invulnerable, even though he has a strategy which has been known to work in the past, although in the past it started a terrific, you know, world war which destroyed the, you know, the players, as it were, mainly the Nazis in Japan. He basically has painted himself into a corner. And, you know, I'm sure there are discussions going on with the Russians now, which are not public, which are trying to come up with a way where we can get Russia out of that corner they're painted themselves into without turning over big chunks of Ukraine. I mean, the latest negotiations, there are peace talks going on right now, and the proposal on the table is a peace deal, a ceasefire, but the Russians want guarantees or some assurances that it will eventually give the Russian-backed rebels in the Donbass, that small section of eastern Ukraine, a sovereignty, you know, there was independence, so they can then be annexed to Russia. And, of course, that's the line in the sand that nobody should cross, because that simply gives Russia what they want, and they'll try it again. So the question is to give Russia a way out that doesn't make Putin look like a greedy, you know, idiot. And give him a chance to, you know, basically clean up the corruption and clean up his own act inside of Russia without causing, you know, a worldwide catastrophe.
Mm. Austin, it really does feel almost like the 1930s again in some respects, doesn't it?
Well, it has some elements of it, Dan, but there are also some changes. Let me add a different line of analysis. You look back at stuff that's been on stuff, material analysis that we've had on Strategy Page over the last 15 years about Russia's situation and the terrible situation that Jim just described. It's very accurate. That said, Russia's reaction to Kosovo, and especially Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence, which is 2008, early 2008, is also very telling. Now, Jim's talked about Russia's profound interest in economic reform and actually, you know, taking advantage of all the wealth creation opportunities that exist in Russia. Now, that's got all kinds of things working against that, including our own kleptocracy and the KGB cronyism. I'm using that kind of a loose definition around Putin and Putin himself. But that exacerbates the situation. So there have to be some changes, though, on the Russians' part. But that said, Kosovo, as the president, quote-unquote, of unilaterally peeling off a province, really had some profound effects, not only in Serbia. And remember, the old pan-Slavism was a little bit of a propaganda pull by the Tsar, but it also meant something, too, at some level. And Russia was Serbia's advocate in the Kosovo situation. And it said, they pulled it away. You didn't follow, according to the Kremlin. They didn't care that NATO and the United States said it was a one-off deal. And that year, with South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, they act, quote-unquote, on the Kosovo presence. And Putin and other leaders in Russia made it clear that that's what they were doing, thumbing their nose at the, quote-unquote, Kosovo president, but also sending a message they did not want Georgia to join NATO. It was a bridge too far, or an enlargement too far. And Ukraine was also, it was an object lesson for Ukraine. That concern is there, too. Now, as Jim says, is it really in Russia's long-term interest to try to absorb Ukraine? No, it really isn't if you look at it from an economic growth and stabilization issue. But Russians also see that it's in their long-term interest to hold on to what they've got. They have profound issues with, quote-unquote, control of areas that are not ethnically Russian. They also see that they've lost control of areas that are ethnically Russian, and take Transnistria and Moldova as an example, or the Donetsk Basin in eastern Ukraine. So it's far more complicated, obviously, than just the economic issue. I agree to some extent with Jim that Putin's painted himself into a corner vis-a-vis, you know, relationships with Europe. Oh, my goodness, the French finally decided to get off of it, and they're not going to sell the Vladivostok to Russia. I wrote a column about that a little over a month ago. I mean, not my idea, but France needed to sell it to somebody else, either the Japanese or NATO, and the NATO idea was even floating around in the spring. German parliamentarians suggested that NATO buy the Vladivostok, and that something be done with the Sevastopol, the second of those Mistral-class helicopter assault ships. They're really powerful ships, and the French completely reversed field and said they're not selling them. You even have the Finns and Swedes talking about joining NATO. That's not total news because they've been so cooperative with NATO, but an overt joining of NATO, that's a slap at Russia. A big time slap. This is part of what Jim means about Putin painting himself into a corner with Europe and with the United States, with NATO as a whole. The reaction down on the southern flank with the Turks. The Turks see, you know, you sometimes see some rhetorical buddy up between Erdogan and Putin because they're both kind of tough guys. Turks don't see this expansion as smart as it is, as totally threatening, which it is. So he's made a bunch of enemies. Putin has. Can he back down, given the popularity of the expansion, at least what we know about the popularity among Russians inside Russia? He'd really damage his standing if he did. So that's what Jim means about being in a corner. But he's done a lot of the painting himself, and there's some thought behind the painting. So it's not just a simple idiom. He's painted himself into a corner. There are some advantages to him if he pulls it off.
Well, I think the Obama administration and actually the rest of the world governments are living the apocryphal Chinese curse may you live in interesting times. And this is going to be very interesting, so to speak, to watch as all this plays out, as there continues to be multiple crises across the world.
Are you saying, Dan, are you saying we've made a pivot to a Chinese curse? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we've made a pivot to a Chinese
curse. I'm going to write a column on that. All right.
Okay.
All right.
All right. We'll talk to you both next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye.